This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has surveyed what she called a surreal, ghostly scene in a devastated village. She pledged quick financial aid and a redoubled political focus on curbing climate change as the death toll from last week's floods in Western Europe climbed above 180. Merkel on Sunday toured a village on the river in Western Germany where many buildings were damaged or destroyed by rapidly rising floodwaters. The frontrunner to succeed Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany's September election has now apologized for a scene in which he has been seen laughing in the background as the country's president delivered a statement on the devastating floods in Western Germany. Armin Laschet is the candidate of Merkel's center-right union bloc to be Germany's next leader. He is also the governor of North Rhine-Westphalia state, which was one of two badly hit by last week's floods. A right group in Russia is shutting down, citing a fear that its members and supporters would be prosecuted after the Russian authorities blocked the group's website for allegedly publishing content from an undesirable organization. The Team 29 Association of Lawyers and Journalists specializing in treason and espionage cases and freedom of information issues said Sunday that Russian authorities accused it of spreading content of Czech group that had been declared undesirable in Russia. The group's website was blocked Friday. Russia is putting mounting pressure on opposition supporters, independent journalists, and rights activists ahead of the September 19th parliamentary elections. Police fired water cannon, tear gas, and rubber bullets on Sunday to stop protesters from marching at the office of the prime minister of calling for him to resign in India, I should say in Thailand. The use of force by the police came after some protesters tried to dismantle barbed wire. This is VOA News. The lawyers for several prominent Egyptian activists and journalists say that their clients were released from custody on Sunday following Mondays and months of detention. They had been arrested on charges including joining or aiding a terrorist group and spreading false news. In recent months, Egyptian authorities have released detainees ahead of major Muslim holidays. Sunday's releases come 2 days before one of the two most important festivals of the Islamic calendar. Egypt's State Information Service confirmed the releases but said no government statements on the matter were immediately available. In the U.S., Los Angeles County residents are again required to wear masks indoors, regardless of their vaccination status, a mandate that health officials hope will reverse the latest spikes in coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. The rule went into effect late Saturday for the nation's largest county, where the rising caseload is led by the highly transmissible Delta variant. L.A. County Supervisor Hilda Solis said on ABC's This Week that the mask rule will save lives. California has seen a steady rise in cases since the state fully reopened its economy on June 15th and did away with capacity limits and social distancing. Two South African soccer players have become the first athletes inside the Olympic Village to test positive for COVID-19. Other cases connected to the Tokyo Games were also confirmed Sunday to highlight the Herculean task organizers face to keep the virus contained while the world's biggest sports event plays out. Positive tests came as some of the expected 11,000 athletes and thousands more team officials from across the globe began arriving in the village, having traveled through the pandemic to Tokyo. The Olympics opened Friday. The International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach has said that there was zero risk of athletes passing on the virus to Japanese or other residents of the village, but that bold statement was already being tested. Recapping one of our top stories, again, German Chancellor Angela Merkel surveyed what she called a surreal ghostly scene in a devastated village in Germany. She pledged quick financial aid and redoubled political focus on curbing the climate change as the death toll from last week's floods in Western Europe climbed over 180. She said on Sunday that while she was in one village in Western Germany, many buildings were damaged or destroyed by rapidly rising floodwaters. And although that particular town didn't have any deaths, other places were not so lucky. More at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Monday, July 19, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Many are missing after a cargo vessel sunk off the coast of Liberia.
It is estimated that they had between 21 to 26 persons on board the vessel. But for now, we have so far rescued 11.
13 people have died in Kenya while tapping petrol from an overturned fuel tanker. Eswatini King appoints a new prime minister, but the opposition said the people did not have a say. And former South African President Jacob Zuma's corruption case is expected to resume today, Monday.
In terms of our Criminal Procedure Act, a prosecutor must be impartial, and if his or her impartiality is in doubt, then the accused person has a right to apply for the recusal of the prosecutor.
And Guinea-Bissau's opposition calls for an international audit of the country's oil and gas contracts. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian authorities say as many as 15 to 17 people are missing after a cargo vessel, the Nico Ivanka, ran into trouble early Sunday off the coast of Liberia. Major General Prince Charles Johnson III, Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces of Liberia, says 11 people were rescued and that the search was continuing for the missing.
On the 17th, around about 1500 hours, the Liberian Maritime Authority reached out to the High Command of the Armed Forces of Liberia that a vessel by the name of MV Nico Ivanka was in distress between the location of Little Basso and Marshall City, and they needed the support of the Liberian Coast Guard. Immediately, the Minister of Defense authorized that the LCG should begin an immediate search and rescue operations of this vessel that was in distress. Around 2300 hours, we managed to rescue the first six survivors. And then around 0300 hours in the morning, we also managed to rescue additional five, making it 11 in total survivors.
Major General, how many people altogether would you say were on the vessel?
It is estimated that they had between 21 to 26 persons on board the vessel. But for now, we have so far rescued 11, and the search and rescue operation continues as I speak to you.
Was this vessel a passenger vessel or a cargo vessel?
Well, according to the Maritime Authority, this vessel was a cargo vessel.
So everyone that was on board was part of the crew?
Actually, they had 9 crew members, a Swedish, 2 Chinese, and 6 Liberian. They also had 9 West African Examination Council staffers that were going to happen to administer the national exam that is scheduled or will begin tomorrow, Monday. And according to our preliminary information, there were some unauthorized people that were not mentioned on the manifest. That is why we are still missing between 15 to 17 persons.
So what is the likelihood that you will be able to find the missing people alive?
Well, again, the preliminary information says that there are some people that took the life vests, and we are hoping what we have also included for our search and rescue is to continue our foot patrol in those fishing villages or towns along the coast. It's possible that some of those people, because of the wave, may have drifted on course, maybe unconscious, maybe helpless.
Major General, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you too, James.
That was Major General Prince Charles Johnson III, Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces of Liberia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. At least 13 people have died in Kenya, while more than 24 are nursing serious burns after a fuel tanker exploded Sunday morning in Siaya, western Kenya. Police say the tanker was avoiding a head-on collision with an oncoming vehicle when it overturned, spilling the petrol that attracted residents who rushed to the scene to collect the leaking fuel. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA.
It was a somber mood on Sunday in Siaya County, western part of Kenya. This is after the residents of Game lost lives while they were siphoning fuel from an overturned petrol tanker that exploded few minutes later. According to the police, the death toll could rise as investigations reveal that there are more missing persons as some parts of the body found in the twisted wreckage of the fuel tanker. The area sub-county commissioner Charles Chacha confirmed the incident.
In that situation, the tanker overturned and the residents ran to go siphon the fuel. As they were doing that, the tanker exploded.
According to one of the residents, Beatrice Odhiambo, the early morning accident woke her up, and when she ran to the scene, the area was up in flames, consuming the crowd that had gathered to get the fuel.
At night, while I was sleeping, I had an explosion. I woke up and ran to the scene. On arrival, I met people who had caught fire running. The fire was too much. We could not help those who were burning.
Eyewitness Caroline Odid said that those who came for the first round immediately after the accident fetched the fuel and went back home safely. On coming back for the second round is when the tank exploded, burning many beyond recognition.
Those who came in immediately after the accident fetched the fuel. But when going back for the second round, the tanker burst into flames and killed people. At this place, there was a group of people who burned, among them a woman, a baby, and some men.
The police report indicates that there are some people who are still unaccounted for. Diana Odongo lost two of her family members.
That vehicle burst into flames. People burned. We started looking for our people and went to different hospitals around, including Siaya Referral Hospital. We checked in all the wards and we could not find our people. That is when we realized they had perished.
The fire brigade arrived on the scene a few hours later as the area member of parliament, Elisha Odhiambo, faults the emergency response team in the region.
I realize that as a country we have a problem. The response time for emergency is very minimal. It's very wanting.
I want to talk to the CS Transport. Bwanamacharia, it is important that you take a keen look at Kenha. You cannot make a road without signage. The reason why this accident and tragedy has happened is because this particular area doesn't have any signage for the drivers to know that they're going through a bad patch.
Deadly accidents involving fuel trucks operating on the busy Nairobi-Busia-Uganda road are not new to residents, as hundreds of people have been killed before in the last few years while siphoning fuel from trucks in accident scenes. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma's corruption trial is expected to resume today, Monday. Zuma was found in contempt of the country's Supreme Court in late June and jailed for 2 weeks. The incident sparked a week of rioting, looting, and property damage, resulting in as many as 200 people dead. Stanley Malimaja is a lawyer with the Southern African Human Rights Defenders Network. He says he doesn't think the court will get to the merit of the corruption charges on Monday because former President Zuma's lawyers have asked the court for the prosecutor to recuse himself because they don't think he is impartial.
We had an address by His Majesty King Solomon III where he touched on a number of issues that are of national importance. At first, he lamented the violence that we experienced in the past 2 weeks, which resulted in destruction of our economy to the value of about 3 billion emalangeni. The king insisted that as Maswati, we are known for peace, we are known for coming around the table whenever there are differences, and he appealed to Maswati to continue doing that tradition and following that tradition and culture, especially following the constitutional provisions that are provided for whenever we want to take a different direction. The king then announced a fund named the Reconstruction Program Fund which will help assist those who have been affected by the spate of violence, which was marked by looting and arson, the destruction of property and the loss, unfortunate loss of lives. He announced that government is putting in a seed of 500 million in Malangeni to start this fund to ensure that the economy revives. On top of that, James, the king also appointed a new prime minister by the name of Pierre Pastipo Dlamini.
One of the demands of the protesters has been the opportunity to have a say in the selection of a prime minister. Did the king take into consideration those concerns?
The king did explain, James, that in Eswatini there is a constitution. Whenever you want to come up with some reform or change, you have to follow the provisions of the constitution. And more than anything, Eswatini will have what you call Sibaya, which is the gathering of the nation and the highest decision-making body of Emaswati, in which every Swazi of any color, of any creed and affiliation comes together in this one roof and debates and deliberation issues, determining which direction the country will take, whether it's politically or in terms of governance. The king reminded Emaswati that these structures are available for them, and Sibaya will still be held at the appropriate time, especially when COVID-19 is no more a threat.
At any time, was the king sympathetic to the concerns of the protesters?
The king believes that Emaswati have the final say in the direction that this country has to take. The king made it clear that he believes that any time we have differences of views or anything, there is never room for violence or any kind of looting or burning of infrastructure. The king expressed sympathy to those who have lost their lives and those who have lost their businesses and livelihoods through these unfortunate incidents that we witnessed a couple of weeks ago.
Stanley Malemaja is a human rights lawyer with the Southern African Human Rights Defenders Network. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Monday, July 19. King Mswati III of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, last Friday named a new prime minister during a people's parliament called the Sibaya amid protests calling for democratic reforms and a voice in the selection of the new prime minister. The king's critics say the selection of the new prime minister, Cleopas Dlamini, is unconstitutional because he is not a member of parliament. However, government spokesperson Sabelo Dlamini says the king acted in accordance with the constitution.
The multi-stakeholder forum has got no faith in the Sibaya concept and its processes. In particular, that Sibaya fails to engage honestly with the whole question of discussing how the country can move forward into a new dispensation under a multi-party order with the new constitution in Swaziland.
I did speak with the government spokesperson, Mr. Sibelo, and he says that the king did exactly what he is supposed to do under the constitution. The king also named a prime minister.
Look, first of all, there is a contestation with regards to whether the king can continue or should continue appointing the prime minister in Swaziland. The second issue is that if he has to continue doing so as he did, he must appoint somebody who qualifies in terms of what people call the requirement of the constitution. In this instance, in paragraph section 67(1) of the constitution, which says that a prime minister shall be appointed by the king from within members of the House of Assembly. Quite clearly, this person that he appointed on Friday is somebody who is not a member of the House of Assembly. So many of us view this appointment as something that has been done outside of the framework of the very constitution that the king is calling upon his own people to follow.
I was reading that you have put forward five demands from the multi-stakeholder forum. What are some of those demands?
The five demands speak to what we see as a process that will take the country out of the quagmire that we are in now. In the first instance, this type of a problem that we're faced with is one that requires an all-inclusive, mediated political dialogue. The second demand is that His Majesty the King and his government must unban all political parties unconditionally. And then number three, we're saying that the current government is not one that can take us out of this quagmire. And therefore, we're calling for the creation of an interim executive authority that will take us into the new dispensation. Number four, we obviously say that the process of the all-inclusive dialogue must result in the adoption by the people of this country of a new democratic constitution that will guarantee, point number five, a multi-party dispensation.
Sabelo Dlamini is the acting spokesperson for the Eswatini or Swaziland government. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. In Eswatini, the Multi-Stakeholders Forum on Sunday released a five-point demand as a way forward for the country. Among their demands, they called for an all-inclusive mediated political dialogue and a total unbanning of political parties in the country. Tulani Rudolph Maseko is the chairperson of the Multi-Stakeholders Forum. He says Friday's sibaya at which King Mswati III chose a new prime minister was a ploy to mislead the Southern African Development Community's SADC Troika into believing that the king was open to dialogue. On the contrary, he says, the king delivered a monologue in which the citizens were not given an opportunity to express themselves.
His trial is resuming on Monday, but I don't think they will get the merits of the matter, the charges, if I can put it that way, the corruption charges, because former President Jacob Zuma, through his legal team, has made an application that the prosecutor in the matter must recuse himself because they don't think that he is impartial and fit. And I think on Monday that's what the court will have to deal with first, because if it doesn't deal with that, then it has the potential of former President Jacob Zuma may rather contesting that his right to a fair trial might be infringed if an impartial prosecutor is allowed to continue prosecuting this matter.
Stanley, the riots in South Africa for the past week took place because of the reaction to the former president being sentenced for contempt of court. Now, what's the latest on the riots?
I mean, the reason for the protest is rapidly shifting away from former President Jacob Zuma's incarceration, and it's focusing more on the ANC government failures to ensure an equal society. So we still have a majority of black people in South Africa who are languishing in poverty. And also what we have learned after our President Cyril Ramaphosa called normally what he calls a family meeting. We have since learned that, the government came out and said they were unprepared to deal with the riots and lootings that we saw. We have also since learned that over 2,500 people have been arrested in relation to the lootings. At the moment, I don't think there's any clarity about what charges the arrested people are facing, you know.
So President Cyril Ramaphosa has said that some of the people behind the rioting, this was an act of insurrection. That is very serious.
I mean, that's what the president says. And also that's what the Deputy Minister of State Security also alleged, that they have 12 names of people who they believe are behind all these riots and lootings.
Stanley, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
You are welcome, James. Thanks for having me.
Tulani Rudolph Maseko is the chairperson of the Multi-Stakeholders Forum of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland. You're speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Guinea-Bissau's opposition party is calling for an international audit of the country's oil and gas contracts after local and international media published the photographs of current administration officials allegedly signing an oil exploration contract with a company in Dubai. The administration of President Umaro Sissoco Mbalo denied signing a contract. All oil and gas deals are supposed to be approved by the country's National Assembly. Opposition party PAIGC leader Domingo Simoes Pereira spoke to Ricky Stryak about the party's request for an international audit of any oil and gas contracts in the country.
But according to our constitution, and all rights applied in Guinea-Bissau is that the people of Guinea-Bissau are the ones to decide when, how, and with whom to exploit their natural resources. When you have all these international media reporting on a contract being signed to exploit those resources, mm-hmm. without the knowledge of the parliament, without the knowledge of the people, something is happening that is completely out of order.
And if I understand it, the government denied actually signing the contracts that the media reported they signed. Is that correct?
Yeah, but if the government denies it, that means that it should charge the entities that are reporting on having that contract. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you have the session of the terms that we have today, it's very difficult really to deny that, because the first person that spoke about this was the Minister of Economy of Senegal. After a visit to our country, he announced that he's following a contract, an agreement that was signed between the two governments to exploit conjointly the natural resources. Mm-hmm. So at that time, the government of Guinea-Bissau, actually the president, the so-called president of Guinea-Bissau, mm-hmm. announced that it didn't exist any contract. So one has to wonder, if there is nothing, why the minister of Senegal was announcing it. Sometimes later, I got this information that three envoys of Guinea-Bissau were negotiating it in Dubai. This, the only objective way to clarify that is to hire an international entity capable and trustworthy to clarify all these aspects. That's what we are asking for.
That was Domingo Simões Pereira, leader of Guinea-Bissau's opposition party. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bissau. Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Champions League finals played on Saturday as Egyptians giant Al Ahly successfully defended their title after beating 10-man Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa 3-0 in Casablanca to secure their 10th overall title in the process. Goals from Mohamed Sharif, Magdi Afsha, and Mohamed El Suya handed Al Ahly the title, with Kaizer Chiefs having to play the whole of the second half with 10 men after Happy Mashiani was sent off right at the stroke of halftime. While Al Ahly celebrated a 10th Champions League title, head coach Pitso Mesomani was celebrating his third as coach and second with Al Ahly, having led them to the crown last season.
We deserve it. We won it. We've been scoring goals in the semifinals. We've been scoring goals all the way. So, yeah, congratulations to the team. Al Ahly deserve the 10th trophy to make history.
Kaizer Chiefs coach Stuart Baxter says the Amakosi players are naturally massively disappointed to have lost the CAF Champions League final to Al Ahly, but hopes the club's fan will give them the credit they deserve.
The players in the dressing room are massively disappointed. While we had 11 on the field, maybe we could have changed a little at half time, but then with 10 men on the field, it became a very, 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 very steep mountain to climb. But yeah, we are very, very disappointed.
Staying with football news, South Africa beat Senegal 5-4 on penalties to win the Southern Africa Regional COSAFA Cup tournament at the Nelson Mandela Bay Stadium on Sunday. Captain Veli Motua emerged as the hero on the day to lead Bafana Bafana to their first COSAFA Cup title since 2016 and fifth overall. South Africa had not conceded a single goal throughout the course of the tournament, but were in danger of suffering defeat in the shootout. The assistant coach of Bafana Bafana is Morena Ramoreboli.
I'm so excited. I'm happy. Last year we managed to win it with the under-17s, and here we are again with the Bafana today. I mean, honestly, it's a great achievement.
In tennis news, Kevin Anderson captured his 7th career ATP title on Sunday, defeating 20-year-old American Jason Brosby 7-6, 6-4 to win the Hall of Fame Open. But that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.
Today is Monday, the 19th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Afghanistan tells its diplomats to leave Pakistan.
It is very crucial at this stage that Pakistan and Afghanistan closely cooperate.
Plus, as floodwaters in Germany recede, what challenges face residents looking to rebuild?
They're really fighting also with a lack of electricity, gas, and running water.
And we start the week by taking a look at some emerging musical hitmakers on the African continent. We'll have these stories and more next. On Sunday, Afghanistan said that it had asked all of its diplomats in Pakistan to return to Kabul. This as Islamabad addresses all of what it is calling security risks and brings to justice those behind last week's brief abduction of the Afghan ambassador's daughter. VOA's Ayaz Gul is in Islamabad and shares the latest.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan is already fragile and, you know, marred by suspicions and mistrust. And now we see this incident that has taken place, although it is still under investigation. And it happened on Friday afternoon, but for the first time, the Afghan embassy informed the Pakistani foreign ministry on Saturday. And then the investigation began, and Pakistan promised that they will quickly, unearth whoever was behind it. So while we were waiting for an outcome of the investigation, because most of the links they have been able to connect, dots they have been able to connect, like where she was, Afghan ambassador's daughter, you know, where she was traveling and how she got kidnapped. But then suddenly this Afghan foreign ministry issued a statement a couple of hours ago that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has ordered all the diplomats, including the ambassador in Islamabad, to return to Kabul until this incident is properly investigated and those behind it are brought to justice.
What do we know more about the actual kidnapping incident itself? Because, you know, the information that's coming out from Afghanistan was that the ambassador's daughter was severely tortured. What have the authorities said about what happened?
This has been confirmed by the medical report that we have seen after her examination was conducted in a hospital in Islamabad, that she was tortured, physically attacked. The statement that the lady has given to the police in Islamabad was that she was out for some kind of shopping for her brother, buying some gift. The interesting aspect of the whole event that she has described in her statement is that she was traveling in a rented car. Like, she wasn't traveling to this commercial area in Islamabad in the diplomatic vehicle, which, you know, the families and all diplomats are bound to use the diplomatic vehicles, which are properly secured. Instead, she was traveling in a cab. And that's when she said that while she was on her way home, this cab driver stopped the car. Some person, unknown individual, entered the car. And that's when he took her hostage for several hours, and then later she was found somewhere in a residential sector in Islamabad. So again, whatever we know so far about this whole incident is from what this victim has described to police. But today, the Pakistani Interior Minister, Sheikh Rashid, told a news conference that they have been able to collect all the footages of the CCTV cameras around Islamabad. And they have connected almost all the dots. Like, they can see the lady driving from one point to another point and to a third point. So they are hopeful, and they have already identified several cab drivers. You know, whether it was a criminal act or whether there were other motives, we still don't know. But it has really dealt a serious blow to an already troubled relationship between the two countries, because it is very crucial at this stage that Pakistan and Afghanistan closely cooperate, because both the countries share a very long border, and Pakistan has been credited with facilitating peace talks between the Afghan government representatives and the Taliban insurgents, which are going on in Qatar.
Ayaz Ghul spoke to me from Islamabad. Volunteers in the U.S. Pacific Northwest state of Oregon were working hard over the weekend to help some of the roughly 2,000 residents displaced from their homes as a sprawling wildfire rages mostly unchecked. Reuters reporter Chris Dignam is up next.
The massive bootleg fire continued to rage in southern Oregon on Sunday, scorching nearly 300,000 acres, destroying dozens of homes, and leaving roughly 2,000 residents displaced in Klamath County. On Friday, the Oregon Department of Forestry listed more than 5,000 homes as threatened, about 3,000 more than a day earlier. Valerie O'Dye, who helps head the charity Relief Angels, was in the small, tight-knit community of Bly to unload supplies, including food and bottled water, to the evacuees.
I was up on the mountain yesterday, and I was able to see some of the devastation and the heartache of people coming back to their homes where they've lived their whole lives, people that have built it literally with their own hands, and it's gone.
Lita Hunter, who heads the Bly Community Action Team, said she expects to see more requests for supplies as the wildfire continues to grow.
A lot of devastation going on in our area. So many people have come in to get supplies here that have completely lost everything. We had a load this morning, came from Silverton, Oregon, and we have a load in the morning coming from Portland. I am in awe of the donations we've received.
The bootleg fire, which erupted on July 6th, is the biggest among dozens of wildfires tearing across the tinder dry landscape of the western United States. And forestry officials said it was Oregon's fifth largest blaze in more than a century. The cause is still under investigation.
Chris Dignam reports for Reuters News. As floodwaters recede in Germany, the death toll climbed to nearly 160 on Sunday, while officials begin the process of rebuilding affected areas. Reporter Sabina Devin spoke to me from Berlin.
So the latest numbers coming out of Germany right now is 157 have been confirmed dead in Germany. We have 30 more deaths already being calculated in Belgium, and hundreds of injured. And with the missing numbers, we're seeing reports from anywhere from dozens, from local communities to some national reporting, calculating as much as 1,300 people missing. That being said, officials are saying to take that number with a grain of salt, because some people are just merely being reported missing because also communication lines are being down. So cell phone towers have also been wiped out. Some regions only have 20 to 30% of cell phone accessibility. The cell phone providers are in the cities right now setting up mobile spots. So we're hoping to get a more accurate idea of what the missing numbers are at the terms right now. So today we had further flooding in sort of eastern central regions of Germany, not quite at the same levels of what we had on Wednesday to Thursday night in North Rhine-Westphalia and as well as Rhineland-Palatinate. But we've already had one reported death coming out of the regions of northern Bavaria and I believe Saxony, that's also suffering under heavy rain conditions today.
Now, you know, there's some reporting that floodwaters were starting to recede, and that was going to be the impetus, really, for authorities and other people to go in to start the rebuilding efforts. And I was wondering what you could share with our listeners about what is being discussed to really help these communities who've been ravaged by the floodwaters to rebuild, and what kind of challenges they face. You mentioned the communication issues, but what else are they facing?
So immediately right now for residents, they're really fighting also with a lack of electricity, gas, and running water. So a lot of residents are being told not to drink the tap water. Filtration plants in the regions were also compromised by the flooding. And we were also sort of seeing they're being told only to use water as much as necessary. So even not running washing machines, being careful about when to flush the toilet and all this. And this is for people who are still able to stay in their home. We're also sort of seeing infrastructure-wise, roadways have been wiped out. So even getting to the area can be challenging. The federal army has put out 850 soldiers into the region to join volunteers that are cleaning up the area. But at the same time, the volunteer response has just been enormous. And of course, on the federal government side, the state of Rhineland-Palatinate, where about 110 people have died, that is really also the area of the Ahrweiler Valley that is the most heavily hit from this. They've already put out a 50 million euro emergency fund. And today, Finance Minister Olaf Scholz told a newspaper that he will be introducing a 300 million euro relief package to the Bundestag on Wednesday. So financial relief is on the way as well.
Now, Sabina, before I let you go, I understand that German Chancellor Angela Merkel was also on site today. What can you tell us about her visit?
So Angela Merkel visited the area today, touring areas in Rhineland-Palatinate with the state minister as well. She had also promised swift and rapid relief for the areas and also described the scene as eerie and ghostly. She even said the German language does not have words for this. More ambitiously, she also said that German politicians need to take a good hard look at their climate policies and say that serious actions need to be taken in the coming years. So we'll be watching for that in the upcoming election politics in the next couple months.
That was reporter Sabina Devins in Berlin. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is about to lift the entirety of England's COVID-19 restrictions on Monday. It's the only country in the United Kingdom where he has the power to do so. Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland all set their own policies. To see how people are reacting to the change as the Delta variant continues to spread, I spoke with reporter Victoria Smith in London.
Yeah, well, we're calling it Freedom Day here, Steve. And I'll tell you what's changing. No limits on how many people can get together. No social distancing anymore. And no masks, although the government says they still expect us to exercise some caution. Now, I can tell you, I've just come home from the centre of London on public transport. The masks are off. And it's a nation divided because there are those who feel they've had enough. If not now, when? They want things to go back to how they were before this little thing called COVID came along. And the other half of the nation is, frankly, pretty terrified because, as you know, we are riding the crest of a third wave here with case numbers going up exponentially, and we're still only 66% double vaccinated. So some people are saying, why not wait a bit longer? Scientists are saying, we're almost there with the vaccination program. Why not wait till more of us are vaccinated, including the under 18s, and then maybe ease some restrictions? But no, this government is going ahead on Monday with an easing of social restrictions, despite, of course, what's happened in the top tier of government today.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because the news has come out that Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the finance minister were in close contact with someone who had COVID-19. And of course, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson was hospitalized last year after contracting it.
Absolutely was. And yes, for all we know, he may have it again, although let's hope not, because it nearly took him last time. We understand it was 50-50 there. The someone, of course, that they were in contact with is none other than the Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, who announced he had tested positive. And of course, he'd been in the room with many senior members of government and many other people. Now, the real controversy with that is that we have this thing called the National Health Service app, which tells us if we've been in contact or near to somebody who's tested positive. And if that's the case, the rule is you self-isolate for 10 days. Unfortunately, Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, decided the rule didn't apply to them. They were not going to self-isolate like the rest of us are told to do. Instead, they were going to have daily tests. Now, this didn't look great when we're just about to have all these restrictions easing, and within 2.5 hours, the Prime Minister and his Chancellor had decided they would follow the rules laid down for the rest of us and indeed would self-isolate. So that's three of our top leading government ministers now having to self-isolate just before so-called Freedom Day, which doesn't look great, and it doesn't look great that they decided that really there was one rule for them and one rule for the rest of us. And that rule means that many of us, perhaps millions, will have to self-isolate over the coming months, with COVID cases predicted to rise, predicted to peak in August and September.
Victoria Smith in London. Tokyo Olympic organizers on Sunday reported the first COVID-19 cases among competitors residing in the athlete's village as its population swells ahead of the start of the pandemic-hit games next week. Reuters' Edward Baran has those details.
Two athletes from the same country and competing in the same sport staying in the village in the Harumi Waterfront District tested positive for the virus, organizers said. Organizers on Sunday reported 10 new cases connected to the Olympics, down from 15 new cases a day earlier. South Africa reported 3 positive cases in its soccer squad. This is the response from the IOC's Olympic Games Executive Director, Christoph Dubé.
There is no such thing as zero risk, and that we all agree. At the same time, the mingling and crossing of population is incredibly limited.
The new infections are testing the layered testing regime designed to ensure COVID cases are quickly caught and isolated. Proponents argue that the growing number of cases underscores the strength of the testing system. Infection rates are climbing among Tokyo's general population, topping 1,000 new cases for 5 consecutive days. Polls show many Japanese oppose holding the games with the influx of overseas visitors it entails.
Reuters reporter Edward Baran. Coco Gauff announced on Sunday that she will not be competing in the Tokyo Olympics after she tested positive for COVID-19. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says government artillery fire has killed 7 civilians. The deaths, which included 3 children, occurred in the country's last major rebel city of Idlib. The French press agency reports the shelling took place hours after President Bashar al-Assad took the oath of office for a 4th term, pledging to liberate areas still beyond government control. Around 500,000 people have been killed during Syria's decade-long war. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa visited Johannesburg's Soweto Township Sunday to view badly damaged shopping centers. It's the scene where at least 10 people have been trampled to death during rioting following the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma. Ramaphosa told reporters that the government was really concerned about what happened and that they must do more to shore up security forces. At least 212 people have died since the protests began. Spyware developed by an Israeli firm and licensed to governments for tracking terrorists and criminals was also used to hack smartphones of human rights activists, business executives, and journalists. That's according to a global investigation by 17 media partners. The Israeli firm NSO Group says the findings of the media investigation are exaggerated and unfounded. Energy Minister of the United Arab Emirates says OPEC and allied countries have reached a full agreement after an earlier dispute roiled oil prices. The comments by Suhail al-Muzawe came after an online meeting Sunday to reach a deal, but he declined to offer details.
This is Science in a Minute.
July 14th was Shark Awareness Day, a holiday that brings attention to one of the world's most misunderstood creatures and recognizes their importance to the ecosystems of the world's oceans. There's a new study from 2 conservation psychology researchers at the University of South Australia, and it suggests hit shark movies like 1975's classic Jaws and others like The Meg and Open Water have changed the way people think of sharks. Researchers assessed how sharks are portrayed in movies and found that 96% of shark films are blatantly portraying sharks as a threat to humans. But conservationists say it's the sharks that are at risk of harm from humans than humans are from sharks, and the world's population of sharks is decreasing rapidly. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Pressure is ratcheting up against former President Donald Trump and his closest circle. His company, the Trump Organization, is under a criminal investigation on suspicion of fraud and other illegal financial dealings. Yet the former president remains popular among Republicans and wields an outsized influence over the party. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekaswara has the story.
Most former U.S. presidents stay largely out of the public eye, except when they're filmed kitesurfing like Barack Obama or launching a scholarship like Bill Clinton and George W. Bush.
People are going to be able to say when they finish this program, I learned a lot about leadership.
Donald Trump is different. He's still holding rallies, attacking President Joe Biden, and amplifying what Democrats call the big lie. In an informal poll at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Texas last week, Trump won 70% of the votes for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. Earlier this year, he hinted he might run again.
A Republican president will make a triumphant return to the White House. And I wonder who that will be.
Whether he will or not could depend on whether the Republican candidates he endorses win in the midterm congressional elections in 2022. Thomas Schwartz is a presidential historian at Vanderbilt University.
Trump still retains a very solid core of Republican support, which gives him a power within the party. It's not enough necessarily to win an election, but it's enough to win a Republican primary, enough to perhaps get renominated. They might lose because Trump carries so much baggage, but he might be able to indeed win the nomination again. And that's one of the reasons why I think Republican office holders are approaching him very cautiously, and you only have a few who are really willing to defy him directly.
Those who do pay the price. In May, Republicans in the House of Representatives ousted Liz Cheney from her leadership position after she repudiated Trump for baselessly claiming that Biden won the election due to fraud, leading to the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters.
We cannot be dragged backwards by the very dangerous lies of a former president.
Trump wields power even amid lawsuits and scandals. His company, the Trump Organization, is under criminal investigation on suspicions of fraud and other illegal business dealings. Trump's lawyer, Alan Futterfass, say the lawsuits are politically motivated.
I think in 244 years, we have not had a local prosecutor go after a former president of the United States. Or his employees or his company. And that is a significant line to cross.
And as Americans continue to grapple with the storming of the U.S. Capitol, a new book revealed that top U.S. military leaders were so concerned that Trump might attempt a coup after losing the November 2020 election, they had planned ways to stop him. Patsy Wiedekaswara, VOA News.
More than 1,000 people marched on the office of Thailand's Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha on Sunday, angry at the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. David Doyle of Reuters News has more.
Thai police fired water cannon, tear gas and rubber bullets on Sunday to stop more than 1,000 people marching on the office of the Prime Minister. These anti-government protesters are calling for Prayut Chan-o-cha to resign. They accuse him and his government of mismanaging the COVID-19 pandemic. The demonstration also comes after the Thai government tightened restrictions. On Friday, it imposed a nationwide ban on public gatherings of more than 5 people. The maximum penalties are 2 years in prison, a 40,000 baht fine, or both. Protester Itinan says he's aware of the risks.
I understand that the situation is not getting any better, but we have to come out and show them that we're not happy about the measures imposed by the government. It's like they only wanted everything to stop at a standstill, but they were not trying to fix anything. Yes, I know that we are risking getting infected. That's why I try to protect myself by wearing gloves and a gas mask, so that would be at low risk.
Police used force after some protesters tried to dismantle barbed wire and metal barricades leading to Government House, where the Prime Minister works. The protest marked 1 year since the first of a wave of large-scale street demonstrations led by youth groups that attracted hundreds of thousands of people across the country. Thailand reported 11,397 infections and 101 deaths on Sunday, bringing its cumulative total to more than 403,000 cases and 3,341 fatalities. The vast majority of them are from an outbreak since early April, which is fueled by the highly transmissible Alpha and Delta variants.
Reuters' David Doyle. And finally, if you'd like to keep ahead of the current trends in African music, we've got you covered. Ethnomusicologist and host of VOA's Music Time in Africa radio show, Heather Maxwell, has this roundup of the latest top three artists on the rise.
So many amazing emerging African artists recently. I just had to do a top three. Kenya, Botswana, and Nigeria are in the house today. How could this be? How could this be? Yeah. How could it be? This is on me. Karen is a 27-year-old singer-songwriter from Kenya. She's been in the game for about a decade or so. She has a music degree from Berklee College of Music, based in Boston, Massachusetts, USA, and has been rocking her solo career lately. In March 2021, she released an EP. It's called Catch a Vibe, including some hot, vibey visuals. Here's another beautiful emerging artist out of Southern Africa, and she's introducing herself.
Hi Heather, my name is Mposibina. I'm very excited to be on Music Time in Africa. I am a singer-songwriter from Botswana and I just released my latest video titled Dikeledi, which is available on YouTube, and the video is entirely in sign language. I just wanted to include the deaf community into my music and yeah, I'm very excited about it.
This is Dereed Fulham Benson, born and raised in Lagos, Nigeria. I'm an Afrobeat, Afropop, highlife musician, and I started my music career 5 years ago. My most recent single is Start to Wear, it's a song about love. Look there to realize, it's time for you to understand. You done made me the one, you done make me the man. I just got signed to Eclair, partially home by Akon, and that's like a real stepping stone for me to keep making music, because I've been an independent artist all my life. And I think you should watch out for my next music coming out soon. It's like to say you love me.
I'm Heather, and that's my top three recent amazing African emerging artists.
That's going to do it for us on this Monday, July 19th. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.